Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We're going to do our part for Halloween later in the hour when we're joined by Marie Mitchell and Mason Smith. They're the co-authors of Paranormal Kentucky, an uncommon wealth of close encounters with aliens, ghosts, and cryptids. And the drive to encourage students from Eastern Kentucky to consider careers in oncology back in their hometowns, where some of the highest cancer rates in the entire nation can be found. First, Eastern Standard contributor Carolyn DuPont recently had as a guest Elliot Morris, a data analyst who explained how traditional polls may be overstating the American appetite for political violence. Carolyn is back with what we think are thoughtful and so maybe helpful perspectives from the right and left about the national mood.
Two guests today, Henry Olson, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where he studies and provides commentary on American politics. His work focuses on how America's political order is being upended by populist challenges from the left and the right. Shadi Hamid is a columnist at the Washington Post and research professor of Islamic studies at Fuller Seminary. He was previously a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a contributing writer for The Atlantic, as well as a member of the Washington Post's editorial board. He is also author of the forthcoming book, The Case for American Power, which will be out on November 11th from Simon & Schuster. So thank you both for your willingness to have this conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So you each published pieces in the Washington Post on September 18th and 20th, and I thought they sort of mirrored one another, one of you writing from a conservative perspective and the other from a more liberal one. You both acknowledge that each side has a narrative about its proponent's propensity for political violence, and you identify some of the events that each side would cite in their narrative. Ultimately, however, is it profitable or helpful to entertain the question of who started it? Henry, let's start with you on that.
I think the question of who started it is one that is not very helpful. I think both sides would point to the other. I've talked for many years with people about, well, when did this polarization start? And each side will point to something, and the fact is both sides are right to some extent. I think what's much more helpful in this case is to acknowledge that both sides are contributing to it. Both sides are continuing it. It isn't a, oh, but it's all on the one, it's all on the other. And I think that acknowledgement is the beginning of wisdom and health to get us back to a path where politics may be sharp, but they're not vicious and brutal the way they are increasingly being in the United States.
Yeah. And Shadi, you actually even proposed that question in your piece. Is it helpful to ask who started it?
You know, I asked the question and I tried my best to answer it from my perspective. I think that we have to do some kind of accounting about the past. I think it is useful sometimes to kind of look inward. And one thing I tried to do in my piece was say, hey, I actually think Republicans are more to blame now, and I should really note that. I think right now, Republicans are driving more of the polarization and fueling more of this sense that everything is kind of falling apart. They're the ones in power. So I think also it's worth saying that if you're in power, you have more responsibility. Democrats now are out of power and are pretty feckless and not really doing a whole lot in terms of leadership. That said, Democrats were in power under Biden, and they were playing a very powerful role during Trump's first term. So I think we have to acknowledge that the Russiagate investigation, delegitimizing Trump from the get-go, the trials of Donald Trump, and this attempt to destroy him through the courts, all of that contributed to where we are now. And it gave Republicans and conservatives the sense that we were trying to defeat them or even destroy them outside the normal bounds of politics. As a Democrat myself, as someone who's on the left side of the spectrum, I have to call my own side to account. And I think all Americans should try their best to do more of that, because self-policing is difficult but necessary. And our own side is the side that we have more influence with. I'm probably not going to convince many MAGA supporters, but maybe I can try to convince some liberals and some Democrats.
I don't know if either of you read the wonderful piece by David French where he says that what we all do is sort of memory hole what our own side does and then magnify what the other side does. And so I think your point about self-reflection here is so important. But that leads me nicely to ask, there is this rhetoric that says, well, the other side isn't playing by the rules, and so we shouldn't play by the rules. It boxes us in. So what's the best course of action when you don't think the other side is playing by the rules? Shadi, let's start with you on that one.
So it's hard because my inclination is to say, let's take the moral high ground. Let's try to be better than our opponents. That someone's got to break the cycle of polarization and radicalization. There's two major parties in this country. If it's not going to be Republicans doing that, there's only one other choice. So, I have argued in the past that come 2028, if God willing, Democrats win, that they should be magnanimous in victory and try to extend an olive branch to Republicans. That said, based on what I've seen in recent weeks and months, where Republicans increasingly want to vilify the entire left and even criminalize perhaps the entire left. I mean, after Charlie Kirk's murder, you've heard a lot from leading Republicans that the entire left is to blame. So that puts us in a difficult situation as Democrats when I try to tell my fellow Democrats, okay, guys, still, come 2028, we got to take the high road. But then a lot of people will say, well, Republicans are being so authoritarian now and so destructive to the country that maybe we have to play hardball in 2028 or whenever Democrats win in order to undo the damage, because the damage will be considerable. And the idea then will be to use state power to really assert Democratic objectives. So I go back and forth on that. I wrestle with myself on that. But when I come to my sort of my senses and I'm more calm and I'm not in the heat of the moment, I then say, look, we got to stick with what the original idea was. If we thought that we should take the higher ground a few years ago and that's the better course for the country, then that's what we should stick to. But I think Republicans are making it hard to really do that because our country really seems to be imperiled. I mean, I've never really felt this way about the future of the country. Sometimes I really lose faith and sometimes I despair. But I think that, so I don't have a clear answer, but I think at the end of the day, someone's still got to break the cycle.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Lincoln in his second inaugural, with malice toward none. And I asked myself, could I have said with malice toward none at the end of the Civil War? But it does feel better to take the moral high ground for sure. Henry, what about you?
I agree that if Republicans win in 2028, presuming that it's not Donald Trump violating the Constitution, who's taking the oath of office, presuming that it's Vice President Vance or someone else, absolutely Republicans should take the high ground, which is to say that we assert our small R Republican values over our large R Republican values. We are Americans first and we are partisans second. I do think one of the things that you hear a lot on the Republican side, the big R Republican side, is things like the seemingly malicious prosecution sent against President Trump, not just by the Biden White House, but by the state's attorneys general or local officials who had campaigned on a pledge to put Donald Trump in jail. Those things happened, and I think Republicans need to get beyond that. But again, you can't say that it didn't happen and that there weren't consequences that could have been had as a result of those actions. And I think that makes for the difficulty of the moment is that each side has its provocations and each side says, well, but, at some point you have to say we're in power and we're Americans and our adversaries are loyal, opposition forces. They are not disloyal revolutionary forces. It is easier to do so against the backdrop of repeated victory. And I think that's one of the issues at stake here, is that you've got so many rapid, close transfers of power that each side doesn't have the security of having won two or three elections in a row, like Roosevelt did, like Lincoln did in 1864. He could be magnanimous when Sherman was occupying Savannah and he had won a reelection that he thought he was going to lose just 6 months before. And that's something that I hope that if Republicans are victorious and they do have that assurance of reelection, that they are magnanimous, because that's what the country demands and that's what would be in the long-term interest of both party and country.
And I think you rightly point out it will never be so easy to be magnanimous as when you win. And so that would be the opportunity for either party to be magnanimous. So what is the line between the sharp speech of politics and, you know, drawing contrast, which we know politicians need to do to win elections? You've got to draw contrast. But the difference between that and language that incites, and how can we really know the difference there? Go ahead, Henry.
It is hard to know the difference. Certainly you go back to Abraham Lincoln and his famous House Divided speech, and you actually read it and you realize that he's accusing the president, the past president, Supreme Court justice, and his opponent, Stephen Douglas, who wants to become the president, of a conscious conspiracy to bring slavery to the North. That's pretty inflammatory. You take a look at Franklin Roosevelt and his statements, particularly in 1936, after 4 years of vituperation from the right. You know, one of my favorite political lines is him in the Madison Square Garden speech saying that my opponents are united in their hate of me and I welcome their hatred. In their first term, they met their match. In their second term, they've met their master. You know, these are hard political words. But I do think we can have a sense of it, which is that all of the time these people would characterize certain figures as being divisive, but they would not characterize the American people as being divisive. Lincoln always reached out to Democrats who were individual to join his crowd. His campaign, that Roosevelt distinguished between Republican leaders or a narrow few with the vast majority of business people and Republican voters who shared a common outlook. And that's something that we're increasingly missing today, is that rather than just criticizing leaders as being wrong in sharp terms, we're criticizing people. And that means that the people themselves feel threatened, and the diseased minds among those people, the ones who are already suffering some from mental issues, come to the conclusion that if they're personally a threat, they need to remove the threat, and hence what's going on.
Yeah, so it's one thing to say something about a politician, but another about a whole swath of people, a whole half of people. Same question to you, Shadi. The difference between the sharp speech of politics and language that incites.
I think we should always err on the side of freedom of speech. That is one of the things that makes America great.
Yes.
Quite different than what you see, you know, our counterparts in Western Europe. We often assume that Western democracies are all vaguely alike when it comes to freedom of speech. That's not the case. Our First Amendment is something really special. And you know, basically, unless you're inciting an imminent threat, one that can be demonstrated, you pretty much have a lot of free rein to say what you like, even if it is inflammatory. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be frightening for a lot of people. But in the end, I'm very much a believer that words are words and violence is violence. And we should be very careful about conflating them. Because once we say that words are violence, or, you know, if people's feelings or emotions are hurt or damaged by what someone says, then pretty much everything can be criminalized or seen as dangerous. Mm-hmm. And we need to have vigorous debate. And sometimes when you have vigorous debates, that means one side will call the other authoritarian. Like, for example, I think it's totally legitimate for Democrats to call the Republican Party authoritarian. And it may not be the most constructive thing to do, but ultimately, if that's what you're seeing, You should be able to call things as they are. I should also note there has been an effort to criminalize pro-Palestine speech in this country by the Trump administration. So that's also something to be very concerned about, that on a number of different fronts, there is a sense that we can't say exactly what we want to say, that we have to kind of look over our shoulder. Even when it comes to Charlie Kirk's murder, I think a lot of us were wondering, well, you know, if we say something, will it be used against us? Will someone try to get us fired? That's the kind of feeling that I think a lot of Americans have right now. And that's something that we have to fight back against, that people shouldn't be afraid of what they can say publicly.
Henry, I wanted to ask you, in your piece, you talked about a rhetoric that forces the other side to choose. And I thought that was really interesting. You went on to say, do they tolerate the violent, hateful few, or do they stand with the spirited but peaceful many? I was trying to think of an example of rhetoric that did that. So what kind of statements are you talking about that forces this kind of choosing from the other side?
I think if I were a Republican strategist, you know, I would not shy away from calling out speech that I thought was over the line. You know, when somebody says that Donald Trump is a Nazi, or when people say it's straight out of the Nazi playbook, or when Governor Newsom says, as he did say, that I'm not sure we're going to have elections in 2028, I don't think that should be criminalized. I agree 125% with Shadi. That is free speech and open speech. But it shouldn't be considered to be normal speech. You know, it is not normal speech to say essentially that the president of the United States and the apparatus that supports him and that the people who support him are essentially no different than the worst mass murderer of the 20th century. So I think that's a rhetorical thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think it should be legally enforced. I don't think people should be, have the force of law, or that things should be removed, like licenses from networks that platform those people. But nor do I think it should be treated as, I think authoritarian is a different thing than Nazi. I think that saying somebody is subverting constitutional norms is different than, you know, a more extreme statement. And I think Republicans are right to note that some of this stuff is really unprecedentedly harsh, and diseased minds who really believe that there's no difference between Donald Trump and Adolf Hitler will not irrationally take matters into their own hands.
It strikes me that some of these words that are thrown around in public discourse, people really don't know what they mean. You know, there's a lot of conflation of these things, different kinds of authoritarianism. And I think there's also a difference between describing patterns that you see and then slurs. And so perhaps leaders could be more careful about that. Shadi, you say that we're running out of time to pull back from the brink, and that we may only be left with, and I'm quoting you here, the simple recognition that we're stuck with each other and that our choice is between finding ways to coexist or watching our democracy wither. So what does that look like in a practical sense? And is there a way for it to come from the ground up when it doesn't seem to come from the top down?
You know, I think we have to acknowledge that there isn't going to be consensus on the big questions in this country, that unity is a false promise. Like, we are a divided country, and we have strong disagreements about existential questions, about what it means to be American, the role of religion in public life, the role of government, the nature of the state. I mean, you name it. And that's okay in a democracy to have those fundamental disagreements without feeling that you need to convert all of your opponents and get them to believe what you do. At some level, you have to accept that. So as a Democrat, that means that there's 70 million plus Trump voters. They're not going away. They're part of our country. They're our fellow Americans. We're going to have to learn to live with them. But that also means that Republicans have to accept that there's 70 million plus Kamala Harris voters, and they're going to have to live with us too. Mm-hmm. The idea that you can defeat the other side and bludgeon them into oblivion so that they accept everything that you want, that is not possible in a country as large and diverse as ours. And honestly, it shouldn't be possible in any country. Pluralism is good. Disagreement is good. That's how we learn. So I think one thing I talk about in my piece is the idea of a kind of institutionalized national dialogue where we get Republicans and Democrats to agree to an explicit code of conduct. There's a number of things that could be part of that. I think one thing we have to renew is our commitment to the democratic process, that we accept outcomes that are not to our liking, even outcomes that seem personally threatening, instead of delegitimizing. So just as Democrats delegitimized Trump after he won in 2016, that was a mistake. He won fair and square. We should have come to terms with that. But it's also true that Donald Trump and many Republicans never accepted Biden's victory in 2020, and they said the election was stolen. This might seem like a very basic, obvious thing, but if we can get Republicans and Democratic leaders to explicitly say, yes, the democratic process is what we abide by. The rules of the game are the rules of the game. So I think that's a first step, because otherwise every election is going to be the most important of our lifetimes, and we're going to treat it as this kind of apocalyptic thing. But we have to accept that sometimes our side will lose.
Yeah. And I love where you went with that, that disagreement is good. And wouldn't it even be wonderful if we could come to understand that we actually would have something to contribute to one another, because it's just not possible that my side is right about everything. We're just about out of time, but I just wanted to ask you each just to cite one figure from the other side that you thought had a helpful response in the wake of recent events of political violence, just very quickly. Henry, start with you.
I'm going to name two, Ezra Klein and John Fetterman. That I think Ezra Klein as a journalist has been very good at being true to being his beliefs, liberalism and progressivism, but has really tried to come to grips with Charlie Kirk's murder. And I think John Fetterman as a senator has been very good at using his position of leadership to say, I stand here, but I don't stand there, and treating Republicans as an adversary but not an existential enemy. So I'd say both of those people have really impressed me in the way that they have reacted, remaining true to their principles, but being Americans first.
Thank you. And boy, Ezra Klein's really been talking across the aisle a lot, and I've appreciated that as well. Shadi, someone from the other side that's had a helpful response.
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to say there's a lot of figures on the other side who have impressed me. I wouldn't maybe use that word, but I think there's credit where it's due, and I'll mention Ted Cruz here. After the chairman of the FCC, Brendan Carr, threatened broadcasters to get Jimmy Kimmel off the air, Ted Cruz spoke out and said that Brendan Carr made a mistake there, that he shouldn't have talked like a mafia boss and threatened the other side. And to hear that coming from someone who's as stalwart a supporter of Donald Trump as Ted Cruz, that makes a difference, to see that there was internal opposition. And actually, there were quite a number of prominent Republicans who were speaking out when Attorney General Pam Bondi talked about prosecuting hate speech, which would be a very dangerous thing. We don't have a hate speech exception to the First Amendment. And she had to kind of backtrack after saying that, in part because of prominent conservatives saying, that's not going to fly, that's one bridge too far, we believe in free speech. So there have been some positive examples there. Are they enough? Probably not. But we have to kind of name those and highlight them when we do hear them.
Yeah. And I just want to say I appreciate the fact I asked you each for one and you gave me more than that. So it says that there are people that are responding in productive ways. Well, I just want to thank you both for being part of this conversation. Henry Olson, Shadi Hamid, look forward to reading more from both of you. And thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having us.
ACTION, an acronym for Appalachian Career Training in Oncology, is a program aimed at encouraging Appalachian students to consider careers in oncology in Eastern Kentucky where some of the highest cancer rates in the nation are found. The program is publishing a series of books, Cancer in Appalachia, a collection of youth-told stories, and co-editor Nathan Vanderford is here to tell us about the most recent volume. Welcome, Nathan.
Tom, it's great to see you. It's good to be back.
And first, if you would bring us up to date on how Volume 1 was received, did it encourage any young people to think about going into oncology with a mind to maybe take it back to Eastern Kentucky?
Yeah, you know, these books are really interesting. I think they're a learning opportunity for the students who write these books. And through that, they learn a lot about writing and about cancer. But then they're encouraged themselves to think more about how they could pursue a cancer career. But then when we publish the books, they become a community outreach engagement opportunity. So then, you know, readers read these stories and they think about cancer and the way it impacts them and their communities. And I do think it encourages people to think about pursuing these types of careers. And we know that it's a recruitment tool also. You know, we have students that have read these books who then get interested in the program, and we recruit them into the program. And so then they start in the pipeline of pursuing a cancer-related career. So then the short answer to your question is yes, I think it's having an impact.
Why does this region have such high rates of cancer?
Eastern Kentucky has arguably the highest cancer rates in the country. Kentucky in general ranks first in the nation in overall cancer incidence, second in overall cancer mortality, significantly greater rates in those 54 counties. And it's really a perfect storm of things. It's not just one thing, but it's a collection of issues that drive these high rates. That is, very high rates of poor health behaviors like smoking, high rates of obesity drive some cancer cases in Eastern Kentucky. But then there's a whole host of other things that fall into social determinants of health, like lower access to health care, lower education rates that correlate to poor health behaviors. There's other things as well that just all come together to create a perfect storm that drive these high rates of cancer in the region.
Well, tell us about this new book. Are these fictional accounts of young people based on their actual experiences with the disease?
That's right. So Volume 1 was also fictional stories. This volume is also stories. We've now published 4 books, as you know, in total. The first 2 were realistic stories. So students wrote about their own experiences or their family's experiences, why they think cancer rates are so high in Kentucky and what they think could be done about it. We wanted to do something different to engage the students differently, but also to engage readers differently. So in these latter 2 volumes, including this one that just came out, they are fictional stories about cancer in Eastern Kentucky. And we really encourage students to think about how they have experienced cancer, either in their families or community members, and how they see things in their families or communities that drive these high cancer rates. And that might be smoking, you know, people that smoke, or it might be low access to healthcare, poor healthcare engagement, any number of those things. And students touch on all those and much more in these books.
When we were talking about Volume 1 back then, one of the things that came up in that conversation was about familiarity with your doctor and how important that really is in rural Kentucky, and how intimidating it can be to come to a city like Lexington and to a doctor that you don't know. And I take it that's kind of one of the motivations in trying to encourage these young people to think about careers in the region in oncology.
Absolutely. And the students know this. I mean, they see their own family members that go through not only cancer, but any number of other health issues. And there's a big lack of connection with providers either in Lexington or out in Eastern Kentucky. You know, they just don't understand people and the why they do the things they do, how they do the things they do, what barriers exist. And so that's absolutely one of the driving missions of this program, to get more students who are from that area, who understand the area, understand the people and the things that they do and the beliefs that they have, and that can create deeper connections with patients. I've seen this with my own family. I mean, both of my parents have had cancer. Both are from rural Appalachia. And they do the same thing. I mean, they do not connect with many of their providers, and that's a huge barrier. Mm-hmm. But my mom in particular, there was one of her physicians who actually was from our county, and man, they hit it off. I mean, they talked about all kinds of things well beyond healthcare, right? And it was a huge connection, and she looked forward to going to see him every time because they could talk about all kinds of things. So that's the hope we have, that these students can make those types of connections with patients from Eastern Kentucky.
Nathan Vandenberg with Market Cancer Center at UK, who along with Holly Burke is editor of Cancer in Appalachia, a collection of youth told stories. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you, Tom. Always great to talk to you.
Coming up after the break, Kentucky encounters with aliens, ghosts, and cryptids. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Marie Mitchell and Mason Smith are co-authors of Paranormal Kentucky, An Uncommon Wealth of Close Encounters with Aliens, Ghosts, and Cryptids. You might recall Marie from her 24 years as news director here at WEKU. She went on to teach communications at Eastern Kentucky University. Mason, also an experienced journalist, holds a PhD and taught English composition at Eastern. Their book is not just a collection of anecdotes and accounts of experiences, but more broadly, an exploration of Kentucky's folklore that raises questions about belief, perception, and the nature of reality. And Marie and Mason are not shy about citing sources for their information. There is an extensive bibliography of resources in the back of the book. Marie and Mason, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thanks.
What inspired you all to research and write about paranormal encounters?
Well, for years I taught English 102 at Eastern Kentucky University, and I got absolutely just worn out with reading story after story about global warming. So I decided I would ask my classes to research paranormal phenomena. So I developed an interest in that.
Mason's always been interested, fascinated, maybe a little bit obsessed about the paranormal. And we humored him all those years. But then he recorded a podcast with Bill Goodman with the Humanities Council. And an editor from the University Press of Kentucky heard it, called him up and said, basically, if you write it, the book about paranormal Kentucky, we will publish it. Well, we collaborate on most of our writing projects, so I figured I'd be doing some of the research and traveling with him, so I might as well just sign on and be a co-author. So that seemed like a very natural thing to do.
Also, I'm too lazy to do it without Marie to keep me on the job.
Well, and you clearly did some research. And you explore the complexities of interpreting paranormal experiences. Do you follow some sort of set of guidelines or criteria?
Well, the one thing that both Marie and I tried to do based on our background in journalism is we never ridiculed the witnesses. Mm-hmm. And we tried to pick cases that were interesting and some famous ones and some lesser-known ones. But we always tried to respect our witnesses because they're the ones who were there. We weren't there. I don't know what they actually saw. And a lot of skeptics, when they come to a paranormal case, they just, oh, it was an owl. It was, you know, the planet Venus or swamp gas or, you know, a weather balloon. Mm-hmm. And we just never wanted to make fun of people.
So we tried to not concentrate on one area. We tried to find cases all around Kentucky. And we decided we're not going to be skeptics or believers, but observers. So we'd gather the information, we'd assess it, and we'd look for alternative explanations, look for patterns and what took place, where the event happened. and many are around rivers, woodlands, abandoned coal mines, ancient Native American burial grounds, ley lines. Many are around historic homes and Civil War battlefields. So we decided to do that and then look at the historical context.
But, you know, in some of these cases, no matter how much we researched, we just, at the end of the day, we had to say, we don't know. We did everything we could to figure out, okay, what did those people really experience? And the standard explanations simply do not meet the facts of the case that the witness reported. And that's what we say in the book. Sometimes we just have to say, we don't know.
As Mason mentioned, these were not fantasy-prone people. They were not hallucinating. They were church-going people, sober people, no drugs involved, often park rangers, hikers, hunters, rural homeowners, and they were desperately wanting answers to what they found to be really a bizarre happening on a normal day, and they couldn't understand it. They wanted to put it in some understandable terms. So we were looking to do that, and we found that sometimes if there's just one eyewitness, it's harder because it's one person with no real proof to support that report other than their conviction that they saw what they believed they saw.
And, you know, Alan Hynek, who was the scientific advisor for Project Blue Book for many years for the Air Force, after all these years of working with these cases, he finally just had to say, you know, these are ordinary people that have had an extraordinary event. And in a way, that's really the best way we can explain it. It's an ordinary person. They're not hoaxers. They're not trying to make money or get on TV or, you know, they're just, but they have had an extraordinary experience.
Well, as we were talking before the interview began, you mentioned what seems to be a common thread here, and it involves light. Tell us about that.
Well, Alan Hynek was one of the researchers that began to worry about this. A number of the people that were working with him on Project Blue Book went from being complete skeptics to thinking that there may be a phenomenon here. Jacques Wallet, who was one of his collaborators, John Keel, who was a journalist and covered a lot of these cases. And they began to argue that the actual phenomena, the thing that's going on, is a flash of light. That's what was real out in reality. And that flash of light seems to kick the witness into some kind of metahypnosis. They lose track of time. They don't know where they are. But then they have an experience of a Bigfoot or a ghost or a UFO or a gray alien. And if that is absolutely, completely, totally real to that witness. But what was actually out there in physical reality may have been nothing more. Well, I mean, it's really something. But the physical reality may have been some kind of flash of light.
Well, Marie, you listed quite a group of people there that have experienced this and for the most part, credible people whose word we should be able to take. What have been the psychological implications for witnesses of these phenomena?
Well, it's not pretty because by being courageous enough to come forward and by ostracizing people and holding them up to ridicule, we're depriving ourselves of collecting data about what really might be out there and what might be happening and how often and the impact. So when you do that, then people are going to be more reluctant to come and report those things. But there are several cases, two that were nationally reported here in Kentucky. One involved the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter in 1955, and that was involving a UFO. Eight adults and three kids were at this farmhouse in Kelly, Kentucky, near Hopkinsville in 1955, and they felt they were being harassed by these little silver men, which a journalist decided should be little green men. That was a sexier thing to do, or somehow they had green in their mind, so it became little green men. But they were at home, and they saw coming down the road these three-foot creatures that were hopping, floating, skimming. Their feet were not touching the ground. They had long arms, claws, talons, elephant-like ears, webbed feet, red glowing eyes. So that was kind of alarming, right? But their hands were raised like maybe in greeting. The farm family felt threatened anyway. So what do? They pull out their guns and they start shooting. Well, you would think that would do some damage to the creatures, but what happened was there was a metallic sound, like a ping, that when they were hit, they just basically did a backflip into the woods and then later came back again. So there was no damage. There was no blood, no anything when they were investigating it. So what happened was there turned out to be a little lull in the action. So the people got into two different vehicles and rushed into town, into Hopkinsville, and to the police station. So the police and the sheriff and even some people, military people from Fort Campbell, came out to investigate. And again, one working idea was it was great horned owls. But again, no blood, no feathers, nothing that would signify the Kentuckians who actually hit something. There was no evidence of it.
Alan Hynek, who we mentioned earlier, was the scientific investigator for the Air Force's Project Blue Book. In his report on this case, he said, it is unthinkable that in a running gun battle with Kentuckians that at least one cadaver has not been found. So he didn't believe that a group of Kentuckians over an extended period of time would not have hit an owl or something that, and of course, when the investigators got there, they found very, very little.
Hmm. Well, the lasting effects were the very next day, the family was further harassed. This just lasted one day. The aliens allegedly got in their spaceships and thought, this is no way to welcome visitors, and took off. So the next day, of course, word gets out. It's a small town, and neighbors and just onlookers come, and they're trampling over the family's, you know, farm and their crops and coming into their home and stealing souvenirs. So they're being kind of harassed again just by neighbors. And then the woman who's renting or owned the house felt very unsafe living there because it was a remote area. So she moves into town with her family. And then what happened was Lucky Sutton, her son, who was there, he wouldn't even talk about it to his own daughter until he was in his 60s. It traumatized him so much, and he was really very salty about the way that his community treated him as some kind of a lunatic by coming forward and reporting this, which was very real to him and very frightening.
And this is not isolated to the Kelly Hopkinsville incident. In a number of cases that Marie and I investigated, the witnesses were subjected to ridicule. The community made fun of them. Oh, you saw some of those little green men. Mm-hmm. Any more Martians coming? Well, of course, you know, you've got to live with that. You know, you kind of laugh it off for a while. But there were a number of people in ghost cases and cryptid cases and, you know, UFO cases where they might have had an important sighting. You know, the information that they could share might have helped to throw a little bit of light on the phenomenon. And Lucky Sutton, you know, told his daughter when he finally did talk about it, he's sorry he ever mentioned it to start with. They should have just not even called the police. Didn't do him any good, and just forget it all happened.
Well, another case that involved Kentucky was the Casey County women. And Mason, you might want to talk about that one.
Well, this was in January of 1977, and these three women had gone together to celebrate a birthday. And they went up for a supper at a restaurant not far from Stanford. And so they had a nice meal and were coming home. And it wasn't that late. And they're leaving Stanford, going down toward Liberty, Kentucky. And then it's a classic UFO case. They see a light in the sky, and then it begins to follow them. And then it becomes a very bright light. And they're driving a 1968 Nova. And suddenly they've lost control of the car, and they're going down this Kentucky highway at 90 miles an hour. And I remember driving a Chevrolet Nova when I was in high school, and I can't believe that the Nova ever got to 90 miles an hour. I mean, you know, UFO or not, the thing veers off onto their car, takes them off onto a road. They're not driving it anymore. Well, then the next thing they know, they're miles down the road. They've lost time, and they don't know how they got there. The last thing they remembered was being just not too far outside of Stanford and this big thing kind of coming in on them. And so they kind of call for help, and they get police involved. And like the earlier case we mentioned, the community ridicules them. They are not supported by their family in the community. They are made fun of.
Even though they passed lie detector tests individually and went through regressive hypnosis, where they remember being taken on board a spaceship and examined, not probed, but examined. And they lived in fear the rest of their lives that the aliens might come back and follow up on those examinations, or they might be abducted again. And they never had closure in their lifetime of what really happened. So they lived their whole lives in fear and no closure whatsoever.
you know, fictional people who encounter the supernatural, like Ebenezer Scrooge, who gets a visit from Jacob Marley in A Christmas Carol. He reforms and he becomes a nicer man. In real life, a lot of times these encounters, the psychological impact, the social impact is devastating. It's not a reform. Their lives are very much turned upside down.
What is the concept of high strangeness as it relates to this?
That's one of my favorite terms. We use it in the book, and it was originated by Alan Hynek, the man we've mentioned from Project Blue Book. And he was just kind of talking about trying to put some kind of category. You know, he was a scientist. He was an astronomer and had been hired by the Air Force for his scientific credentials. And there is no category for this. There are all kinds of different experiences that seem to fall into the same general category of just encountering the numinous, the unexplainable. And he didn't have a good, clean term for that, so he came up with the term high strangeness.
Well, speaking of high strangeness, there is an account in the book about odd creatures in Lake Harrington and Kentucky rivers. What sorts of creatures are we talking about there?
Well, Lawrence Thompson, a UK professor who had a lake house at Lake Harrington back in the 70s, reported seeing a pig-snouted swimming animal with a curly tail and pink skin, and the tail was about 15 to 20 feet long, and it swam very fast alongside some boats, but it seemed to be a very shy creature. Now, he didn't call it a monster because he said it's just something we haven't seen before that doesn't make it a monster, which was kind of an interesting way of looking at it. And it earned itself the name either Hairy Underwater Bigfoot, Giant Eel Pig, or the Harrington Lake Monster. And some thought maybe it was just feral hogs because the Fish and Wildlife people were always kind of trying to deal with feral hogs that had been contaminated. Some of the waters have been contaminated by people pouring meth into it. And so that was one possibility. But it's not really been seen in intervening years. So it's kind of a mystery. Some say it could be a throwback, an ancestor from dinosaurs that are living in underground caves and adapted to be able to breathe under there. So that's really still kind of up in the air. Maybe it swam before dams down up the Mississippi, Ohio, Kentucky, and Dix Rivers to Lake Harrington, which would have to be a pretty spunky fish to,
sure
to last that long.
Well, speaking of spunky fish, here's one that I've heard about many times associated with some of the dams that we have here in Kentucky, and that is giant catfish. What can you tell me about them?
Well, I have a high school buddy who was a scuba diver, and a colleague of his was called by the Muhlenberg County Rescue Squad. A pickup truck had driven off into Green River in Muhlenberg County near Kinchlow's Bluff and was they need to recover this truck. Now, no one was killed in this accident. I think some had been drinking and he managed to float to the surface, but they need to retrieve the truck. So they called a scuba diver in. He goes down and he locates something big and cold and he puts his hand on it and then is signaling for more cable to hook onto this truck. And while he's waiting for the cable to play out, this big metal thing, or this what he thought was metal, swims away. And so he comes back up, takes off his gear and said, call somebody else. I'm not going down. So I don't know how they ever got that truck out of the river, but it was not that man because he'd had enough.
Yeah, I've heard of these things getting pretty big because as you mentioned earlier, they tended to congregate at the inlet or in some way near where food and nutrients were coming in, and they actually could grow quite large.
Well, they continue to grow, and I always heard the stories around Kentucky Dam and Barclay Dam that the intake somehow was drawing food, and they just lay on the bottom and ate and ate and ate until they became huge.
Some supposedly were as big as a school bus and a mouth large enough to swallow a small child, so that's pretty frightening.
That's a lot of sandwiches, too. Well, this book is fascinating, and there is one story in here that I definitely wanted to include, and it's the very end. It's the story that you end with, and it's your own story. Tell us about the little red hen.
Well, this is Marie and my favorite story, and you'll understand why as I tell this. When I was a child, my sister and I had one of those little golden books of the little red hen, and this is a story of an industrious hen who wanted to bake some bread, and she had some worthless friends that she was asking to help her, and they never would help her. You know, will you help me, you know, harvest the wheat? Not I, said the dog. Not I, said the horse. Not I, said the cow. Not I, said, well, I'll do it myself, said Little Red Hen. And she did. Well, that was one of my mother's favorite stories, and she read that to us 100 times. And she always really punched it, you know, when she told that final story. And Marie and I have 4 children, but and have had, you know, dozens and dozens of books for those kids, but not The Little Red Hen. To my knowledge, we never had that book, and we never told that story to the kids. Well, one night our oldest daughter was ill and had some kind of bug, and Marie and I just could not get her to be comfortable. And we tried everything we could, and we could hear her fussing on the baby monitor. And then in the middle of the night, you know, we'd kind of got her settled. But in all the fussing, suddenly it just stopped, just like someone throwing a switch. And we kind of were scared, and we kind of rushed in there. And, you know, Ruby Margaret, are you okay? And she said, oh, I'm fine. Grandma's here, and she's going to read me a bedtime story. Well, both my mother and Marie's mother had passed away years ago, so it was not someone that she had ever known or been able to reference. And we probably should have been more concerned than we were, but we were sleep-deprived, and it was 2 a.m, and it was time to go to bed. So we checked the closets and under the bed to make sure there were no intruders, gave Ruby Margaret a hug and a kiss, and went on back to bed, didn't hear another sound. So in the morning breakfast, we said, well, hey, Ruby, how'd it go with Grandma last night? Oh, fine. Fine. Well, I'm glad it went fine. What story did she tell you? She told me The Little Red Hen. And her favorite part was the last line where that hen, and she does the gesture, you know, just like, I'll do it myself, said Little Red Hen. And she did.
Wow. So how do you figure that happened? Is there any possible explanation?
None we could come up with. It was just so bizarre. Again, she didn't know either of her grandparents. My mother passed shortly after Ruby was born, and there's no way she could have a memory. We did have pictures, but not enough around the house that at that age she would really have connected. And Mason's a storyteller, and he tells stories about his family all the time, but he never talked about that book. So,
and you didn't have the book in your house?
No, we didn't. Strangely enough, we didn't.
Well, I think that's...
It's one of those we just don't know.
Which is basically what this book is about. Marie Mitchell, Mason Smith, the co-authors of Paranormal Kentucky, An Uncommon Wealth of Close Encounters with Aliens, Ghosts, and Cryptids. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interviews. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Have a question or suggestion about something you'd like us to look into? Record it on your phone and email the MP3 to es@eku.edu with your name and town. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.